Well, hello and welcome to QVD Book Club, the podcast. Today, I am going to steal a line from Taylor Swift because I do think it is fair to say Agatha Christie never goes out of style. If you think about it, her work has endured and been adored for generations, and she always seems to get a new legion of fans, books, movies, podcasts come out. So today we're going to meet someone who I think is a little bit of a guru. He's paid a real tribute to Agatha Christie with his book, The Busybody. Kemper Donovan joins me. He's based in the US and we're having a great chat about his brand new book. Let's have a listen. It is a pleasure to welcome from LA, Kemper Donovan. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me. I'm so thrilled to be here.
Oh, it's fantastic. And it's so great to chat to you. I know this has been out and about and making lots of people very happy. You've been in and around the business a long time, but it must be fantastic to get something you love so much out there.
It's so exciting to finally have this mystery out in the world. It's, you know, these things are always a long time developing, but I'm such a mystery fan, as I'm sure we'll be discussing, and I've been working on this mystery for a long time. So I've just been itching to be able to discuss it with everyone and for everyone to read it. And it's just a thrill now that it's finally here.
I guess it's fair to say you're on Agatha Christie tragic, and what a road that you've taken, celebrating your idol in many ways, in a literary sense, and certainly starting to shape a career out of it.
Yes. I mean, I have devoted the last 7 years to delighting in all things Agatha Christie. I always have to give the caveat that the podcast I started 7 years ago, All About Agatha, was very much a joint venture with my dear friend, Catherine Brobeck. She passed away 5 years into the venture, and the book is actually dedicated to her because I never would have gotten to the place where I realized that I had to write a mystery due to my passion for the genre without Catherine. And that was just very much what we did as we started this podcast. And I am now continuing on with the podcast solo, but the two projects very much go hand in hand, the podcast and this mystery here.
It's a really interesting, and I know it's been such a difficult couple of years for you, losing her and for the family and for the fans, because so many people, I mean, you've got an enormous fan base around the world. I know even in Australia, lots of listeners as well. And what a beautiful legacy that you were able to do something like this to pay tribute to her as well.
Yeah, it really, after she passed, I still had a couple of novels to review because the original project of the podcast was to reread, review, and rank every single mystery novel that Agatha Christie wrote, which is a pretty crazy endeavor because she wrote 66 full-length mystery novels. So we had six more to go, and I was able to draw on a number of the friends that we had made in the Agatha Christie enthusiast / scholar community. And it's also just been so lovely to get to know so many people around the world who are as passionate about Agatha Christie as Catherine and I are. Many, many of them in Australia, by the way. I've had so many great correspondences with fans in Australia, which is why I was so excited that the book is specifically coming to Australia with this beautiful cover, by the way. That is an Australia only cover. I
know,
love
it's beautiful,
that cover.
Isn't it?
It's really beautiful. Yeah.
Isn't it amazing when you think about the impact Agatha Christie has had on people's lives, but, you know, in writing? Because you think about these days, there's almost a cult around a lot of authors, you know, because of social media and the longevity of a lot of the great crime writers and authors we have right now. Everyone knows them. They've got these great careers. And here's this woman who we really didn't see much, but she wrote for so long. And I don't think a lot of people would even realize 66 is a big number of books.
It's a big number of books, and what's amazing about it too, and now I can say this with authority, having devoted 7 years to rereading them closely and ranking them and comparing them to each other, there are certainly other authors who wrote a ton of books, even more than Agatha Christie, but often the quality suffered due to the quantity. And I'd say a good two-thirds, at least, of those 66 books are brilliant and close to masterpieces. It's really not until you get to the bottom third of the roster of this master grid that Catherine and I created, where some of the books then start having some flaws or some issues where you say, okay, maybe that one isn't firing on all cylinders. But it is remarkable how many great mysteries she also wrote. So she, you know, the quantity did not come at the cost of the quality whatsoever. And that, I think, is rare.
Absolutely. I remember as a kid having, you know, the bookshelf with, I mean, with the Encyclopedia Britannica, so I'm showing my age, but we had all these hardback series of Agatha Christie. And I'm so boring to say to you that I'm a Nile girl, I'm a Murder on the Nile kind of girl, because I know there are probably more great, but I just remember that so much as a kid because of the imagery of Egypt and, you know, everything that happened. What is your number one?
I mean, don't be ashamed of being a Death on the Nile or Murder on the Nile, as the theatrical adaptation is known, because that's absolutely one of my favorites, and it's in our top 10. It's such a vexed question, one that I get asked all the time and have had to consider a lot. What is your favorite Christie? Because I could just point to the top ranked novel of the podcast, which would be Five Little Pigs. But that's probably not my favorite Christie, even though I do think it's the best Christie. The one I have the most affection for, me personally, is The Murder at the Vicarage, which is the first Miss Marple novel. And it's not a perfect novel by any means. I'm not even exactly sure where it is in our rankings. I think it's around 20 out of the 66 or something like that. But I just absolutely love it. And I absolutely love Miss Marple as well. I often force on the pod, when I have guests on the podcast, I force them to ask the question Marple or Poirot. And I am very clearly a Miss Marpleite, and my former co-host Catherine was very much on the side of Poirot, which is why we complimented each other so well. But I'm Marple all the way, so I think that also is a big reason why I love Murder at the Vicarage.
I love it. I love it. And yeah, sorry, Death on the Nile. I'm a Poirot girl myself as well. And I've just loved over the years, the movies we've seen, all the things we've done. And it's so fantastic that you've had a podcast that has been so widely loved and able to analyze it. So Catherine, is the reason that you decided, or you had the courage to say, I can do a book, or was it always somewhere in the back of your mind that this is what you could do?
So I published one novel before the podcast, but it was not a mystery. It was a literary novel, sort of a contemporary love story, actually set in Los Angeles, where I live. It did have an element of suspense to it, though. And looking back, even though I didn't realize it at the time, I think I wanted to write a mystery, and it was like I was almost trying to write a mystery, but I wouldn't give myself permission to, because I have always been such a big fan. But it sounds strange. I think didn't have the self-knowledge as to how big of a mystery fan I truly am until a year or two into the podcast, where I realized I am in no way sick of talking about Agatha Christie, even though Catherine and I, you know, record the podcast, prepare for the podcast, have to edit the podcast. I mean, spending tens of hours a week in addition to all of the other stuff that we do. I'm still loving all of this. So clearly I'm passionate about this to a degree that I did not even realize. Why don't I try my hand at writing a mystery? And The Busybody is a direct result of that realization.
Do you know what's really lovely? And for me, I have to obviously read a lot of crime, getting to do this great job. And so often I'm in a dark place, or it's very disturbing. This was just so entertaining. Do you know what I mean? It's smart and it's clever, but it was entertaining. And that's, I guess, that's Christie-ish as well, isn't it? Because you feel like you're part of something.
It really is. I mean, that is an element or an aspect, I think, of Christie that gets under-recognized, because I think sometimes some of the adaptations of her work, both on film and TV, tend to be darker than the texts themselves. And what Christie was so good at was, I think, marrying moments of lightness and humor with the darker moments that necessarily have to occur in a murder mystery where people are dying and, you know, horrible things are happening. And that, I think that goes a long way toward why her books work as well as they do. So it was really important to me to write a murder mystery that also was entertaining and diverting and had lightness and humor in it, but not at the expense of, I didn't want it to be a parody either. I wanted it to be a real grounded murder mystery, but one that also did have those moments of lightness and humor in it.
Absolutely. And that's such a perfect way to describe it, because the most recent adaptation, Haunting in Venice, was very dark and kind of frightening. So that's an interesting way to do it. Well, the way you've taken us on the journey is with a ghostwriter who, I think it's incredible, by the end of the book, we still don't know our ghostwriter's name. We never do. How great to get through a book and not know the main character's name.
Yeah, so there are two reasons for that. I did not, when I started writing the book, make the decision at the outset that I wasn't going to name this first person narrator, this enigmatic and withholding ghostwriter. But the name never really came to me, and it continued not to come. And I started to think to myself, and it's so funny because I would always roll my eyes when authors would say things like, oh, well, the character just made me do it or told me what to do. And it's like, no, they didn't. You created the characters. You're the one in the driver's seat making the decision. But it was just an organic decision, I'll say, to not give her a name ultimately. And then what I also loved about it is that it's very much in homage to Daphne du Maurier's Rebecca, which very famously features a nameless first person female narrator. And I've always loved Rebecca. And it's a very particular type of mystery. I wouldn't say that it's even often categorized as a mystery, but I think a lot of mystery lovers also have a lot of affection for Rebecca. So I hope it makes people think of that novel.
Oh, that's lovely. That's a nice way to explain it. Well, our ghostwriter, unnamed, is an introvert. And I love the way you describe it without actually saying it, because you give us all of those amazing quirks along the way about why she does what she does.
Yes, she's got a lot of quirks, definitely. And if you're going to narrate a book from the first person, I think you want to make your narrator interesting and likable / sympathetic in a certain way. And she is definitely, I wouldn't say that she is necessarily quote unquote likable, but I think that she has a lot of interesting characteristics to her. And hopefully she's someone who you want to be on many rides with, because she is actually the sole character who is going to travel to future books, because this is also the first in a 3-book series, actually.
Absolutely. And you're right. It's not that she's likable, but you want to be with her and you're interested in her because she is funny and smart and harsh at times. Like, it's quite interesting. And I really, you know, it was great having someone who's been a ghostwriter for so many other types of people, is she's able to give you all of this great information and her background knowledge, you know, of so many things, be it entrepreneurs in residence or incels. Like, she knows a lot about a lot of stuff, doesn't she?
That allowed me to, I think, sort of pontificate on a lot of different little topical matters. And I mean, that's also very Christie-esque. The interesting thing when you really read Christie's texts, she was just a very widely read and well-read and intellectually curious person. And there are a lot of little throwaway comments where you're like, oh, that's interesting. And I didn't even, you know that. It makes for a very sort of full reading experience. And I very much wanted to do that as well with this book.
And it makes you, like, I think about the number of times I jumped out of it and Googled, is there such a thing as a crystal palace in Maine? Is there such a thing, you know, like, it's great because it gives you something outside of the book to wonder about.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I'm glad that you thought the Crystal Palace in Maine was maybe a real thing. That's very exciting.
So we should get to the story, because our ghostwriter gets a fairly exciting assignment, doesn't she?
Yes, she does. So she gets a phone call that a female politician who has recently lost the presidential election in the United States in a very public way finally wants to settle in and write that memoir that she had always been meaning to write but never had the time to write. But now, in the wake of this big defeat, she, of course, has all the time in the world. And this is a former senator from the great state of Maine. So the book takes place in Maine. Her name is Dorothy Gibson. And we can talk about the inspirations for Dorothy. There are two major real life inspirations.
Okay, I'm throwing it out there. It's not Sarah Palin. And is it Kamala Harris? Is it Nancy Pelosi? Or is it just Hillary? Where did it all come from?
So Hillary Clinton is clearly a big inspiration for this character, but not just Hillary. So there was a senator from Maine. Her name is Margaret Chase Smith, and she actually broke into politics on the national stage by way of this phenomenon known as widow's mandate. And I don't know if this happened as frequently in Australia as it did in the United States. My guess is that it probably did, though. So this was earlier in the 20th century. Sometimes when a male politician would die, his widow would be called upon to fill out his term until a more suitable, using air quotes here, replacement could be found. And of course, by suitable, they meant male. And a lot of these women refused to go. And they then embarked on, you know, very successful political careers of their own. And Margaret Chase Smith is an example of this. She became a U.S. representative in the wake of her husband's death. He had been a U.S. representative for Maine. She did that for a couple of years, and then she became a senator for decades. So she has this storied career And she's most known nowadays for having delivered this fiery denunciation of McCarthyism on the Senate floor. It was called the Declaration of Conscience, and it was this really big moment. Yeah. And I'm a big fan of hers. She was a Republican, but she was a sort of an aisle crossing, very bipartisan, pragmatic sort of a Republican from the mid to slightly later 20th century. And Maine is also a state that prides itself on its independent spirit of a spirit of bipartisanship. So it really felt like the right state in which to place Dorothy Gibson, who is very much in this mold of a Margaret Chase Smith. So she and the ghostwriter sort of hole up together at Dorothy's house in the woods in Maine. And this is very much evocative of that period where people were taking photos of Hillary Clinton on long walks in the woods outside of her house right after she lost the 2016 election. That was kind of the nugget that I began with for the book, because I just figured to myself, this is such a weird moment in our country's history. And I think it would be a great setting for a murder mystery. So a neighbor dies under suspicious circumstances and a murder investigation ensues from there.
I love our ghostwriter is embedded almost like a correspondent with Dorothy, which is, as you tell us right off the top, something she wouldn't normally do, but in this case seemed necessary. And it's great because it means she's in the heart of it and right there and sees and hears everything from the security around to the workers to what is going on at the neighbor's place.
Yeah, she's a great way in. And I think one thing I learned from being a scholar of mysteries for the podcast is that I think a key sort of characteristic of an amateur investigator is being on the margins somehow, being a bit of an outsider. And I think the ghostwriter is very much an outsider, both because of what she does and who she is. She's someone who I think has a hard time joining the group and feeling like she belongs. But also her career is one in which, you know, you sort of do have to exist at the edges and be very observational and never really make the connection, you know, make the full connection so that you're on the inside. You always want to be on the outside. And then Dorothy Gibson, as well as someone who has a lot of power, so I'm able to draw on her political and sort of logistical power within the state of Maine at key points in the plot. But she is someone, given what just happened to her, losing this election, she's very much on the outside looking in as well. So it felt like a dynamic amateur detecting duo.
Absolutely. And, you know, it was just such a book of now in so many ways because of what is going on in your political world and everything we're seeing and hearing, that she was so adored or vilified, you know what I mean? And I think that even in Australia, we understand what's going on over there. And to what I loved about Dorothy, though, was she was politically savvy and she knew and she did the things and said the things she needed to. But in essence, she was a really good person, you know, and caught up in all of that.
It's that time of year. Our catalogue is out now for the mums and the other great women in your life. A book absolutely is the gift that keeps on giving. It gives that woman in your life, your mum, your grandma, your carer, time out. I reckon they've earned it. So take a look at the QBD Mother's Day catalogue out now.
Yes, absolutely. She is someone who I think always had the best of intentions and in some ways was thwarted by the realities of politics. And there's a universality to that. I mean, I think no matter where you are in the world, politics is just sort of a crazy game to play. But it's fascinating, too, because of its craziness.
You've got some wonderful characters around it. There is an unreasonably beautiful man, which I just love that phrase. And I now think I'm going to refer to very handsome strangers as unreasonably beautiful men. But your character, of course, we have to have a very small cask. It is Christy Yesting that way. And we get to know them. And they are quite the mixed bag, aren't they?
Yes. They're a sort of quirky assembly of characters. Hopefully not too quirky, but just quirky enough for purposes of a murder mystery. And, you know, that was one of the challenges of the book, because I'm sort of starting where the ghostwriter is being introduced to Dorothy's world. So it's almost like there's a first world that I'm describing, which is Dorothy's world at her house. And then there's this second world, which is at a neighboring property. And that is where the Crystal Palace comes in. It's this very, very bizarre sort of a place where a group of people had been living when this our central murder victim dies. And, you know, so then it's sort of a second introduction, as it were, to another cast of people. But between the two, I think it's it ends up being a nice, robust selection of interesting characters, or at least I hope it does.
Absolutely. And it is great to be in a place that is so, like the Crystal Palace is so unusual and strange. So, you're visualizing it and imagining what they're doing and all of the little bits you throw in about that building and its uniqueness. It's how you can just see that this sort of thing can take place.
Yes. Hopefully it's, and location ends up being key to, you know, to the mystery itself. And that was the other thing, you know, I wanted to create a story that had all of the elements that I think people value in any literary endeavor, you know, such as setting and good characters and, you know, a sense of tone and pacing and whatnot. But I wanted to tie all of those to the solving of the mystery, because this really is a puzzle mystery where the reader can pick up on clues and actually solve the mystery for herself, simultaneous with, or perhaps even just before, Dorothy and the unnamed ghostwriter do. So I think it's important to not to waste anything when you're doing that, because it's almost like you have to do two things at once. You're creating a story, but you're also creating a puzzle at the same time. And Christie didn't even always do that. Some of her books really are just linear thrillers, but my favorite Christie books are the ones where she's telling a story and she's also creating a solvable puzzle at the same time.
At the same time, yeah, absolutely. It is thoroughly modern. You know, you've got lots of sort of popular, like very current, you know, issues of the time that come up. And your observations are just so interesting. I did find myself touching my neck a couple of times. but, you know, things like being antisocial at a funeral, like there's so many just little things. And because of the way the ghostwriter narrates and talks to us, it's just, it's really great way to drag you in.
Yeah. I mean, hope that I was also, I think, inspired by many engaging first person narrators from mystery writers. And I'll just keep on talking about Agatha Christie, because clearly I could just do that all day. But, you know, I love Hastings, who is the first person narrator of some of the Poirot novels. She dispensed with him pretty quickly because she got tired of him. But that's why I chose very carefully when I was figuring out who the ghostwriter is and how she would interact with the world, because you need a narrator who doesn't know everything right away and who can't figure out everything, or else there's no mystery, right? But I did want to create someone who was savvy and smart and spirited and had all of that attitude that would make her a really entertaining storyteller. It's just that I think she can sometimes get a little too focused on things, and she doesn't necessarily have the perspective that a really good investigator or a quicker investigator perhaps would have to get to the solution that much more quickly. Cause I don't want her to get to the solution until 300 pages after the beginning.
That's funny. And now this might be mildly controversial, not very PC of me, but I found myself at times thinking, I can't believe a man wrote this book. And I know that, I mean that in a bad way, but the way you move in and through characters, it's so like, I don't know if you've had that before, but it was kind of cool. You know, I kept thinking it's amazing to me.
I take that as the ultimate compliment. I mean, and I know that, you know, this is all subjective. So I'm sure there are people who might read the book and not feel like it is authentic to a female voice, but I have gotten that response before, and I hope I continue to get it again, because I that's absolutely means that it's working. And, I don't know what to say other than that. That's what I chose, and it's what I wanted to do. I mean, the super personal reason I think probably behind it is that I've always been a man who chooses to surround himself with women. My best friends have always been women. It's kind of the world in which I love to live, and I was like, of course my first person narrator is going to be a woman. There's just I wouldn't have chosen anything else. But that's always the risk when you're not writing exactly, you know, along the lines of your identity, which of course that you eventually have to do, or else you're going to have a very boring story, you know. So every writer has to negotiate those differences eventually, but you hope that you're doing it with authenticity, and I think also just with care and respect. And that is the best reaction I could possibly get. So I'm thrilled that you went there. Thank you.
It's really interesting. And I know lots of writers over time write male and female characters. I mean, I even look at someone like Michael Connelly now, you know, he's had Bosch and Haller for years, but he's got Ballard coming in, you know, he's got like some of the great writers, they all do it, but it just struck me partway in, oh, that's right, it's Kemper. Like Kemper's a bloke, and you know, like, so I really loved it. And I liked the way you told it because I felt there was a boldness about not only our ghostwriter, but also with Dorothy as well. And yeah, I thought it was a really enjoyable way. You tell us this is the first of three. We're getting a couple more. Are those stories already in your head? Are those mysteries and locations already with you?
Yes. So I can tell you that the second book, and this is the great thing about having a ghostwriter also as my series long character. So instead of a more traditional series where it would be the detective and the sidekick who travel from book to book, we are saying goodbye to Dorothy, actually. And it's going to be the ghostwriter sidekick who travels into future books. And she's going to team up with a different detective in a different setting in each book. So it's a sidekick series. And the second book is going to take place, speaking of Death on the Nile, lots of allusions to Death on the Nile. It's going to be entirely on a boat.
Ooh, I like it. And I hope these detectives are nicer than Locust, because he was not a very nice dude in this book.
Yes, yeah, there are some foils to our amateur sleuths here in the form of two male police detectives who hopefully are also a little bit of comic relief / love to hate kind of characters. Yes.
Absolutely. Well, that's exciting to know. There's two more to go. And I do wonder if it will indeed stop there, because I feel like there's so much scope for you to be able to take this wherever you want to go. So congratulations.
Thank you so much.
So great to have it out there. And we look forward to the next one as well.
Oh, thank you. This was such a pleasure to talk with you. I had a great time.
Thanks for your company on QBD Book Club, the podcast. Back soon with more author insights.